ACT Radio is taped and produced at the KTEP studios at the University of Texas at El Paso. The views and opinions expressed on ACT Radio are solely those of its participants and do not necessarily reflect those of KTEP, its staff, or management.
Welcome to ACT Radio, Animal Concerns of Texas. I'm Greg Lawson.
I'm Tom Linney.
And I'm Liz Walsh.
Here on ACT, we talk about how we humans relate to other animals.
We talk about how we use them for food, clothing, and entertainment, and how there are humane alternatives to these practices.
And we discuss why a plant-based diet is the healthiest for humans and the best thing that one can do for the environment.
So if you're concerned about the environment, if you're concerned about your health, if you're concerned about the way animals are treated, stay with us for Animal Concerns of Texas. Coming up on today's show, we have a conversation with Will Tuttle, author of the best-selling book, The World Peace Diet. That's coming up a little later on the show, but first some news.
Mangabay.com reports that although Africa is famous for its lions and other large carnivores, populations are dwindling and even vanishing all over the continent. A new study published in Tropical Conservation Science quantifies the disappearance of the lion, cheetah, and the wild dog from 41 protected areas in West and Central Africa and finds that together the three species are disappearing from 74% of the sites they once inhabited. The authors focused on these 41 protected areas devoted to the conservation of biodiversity that are scattered throughout 15 countries in West and Central Africa. They compared historical data in the published literature on the occurrence of the three large carnivores at each area around the time it was founded, which went back as far as 1925, to current data published within the last 5 years. They found that lions are extinct or near extinct in 23 of the 38 protected areas where they were present historically. The pattern is more prominent in Western African countries where lions have vanished or are nearly gone from 15 out of 18 protected areas. In Central Africa, lions have disappeared or are nearly gone from 8 of 20 protected areas, and their status could not be verified in one. According to the study, cheetahs were historically much less widespread throughout the areas than the lions, and cheetahs have now disappeared or are nearly gone in 11 out of 15 protected areas. Wild dogs are in the most dire situation of the three large carnivores studied. They've disappeared or are nearly gone from 28 of 31 protected areas. The authors point to several factors that contribute to the disappearance of large carnivores from these areas, including disease, declining prey populations, and the threat from humans inside areas or on the periphery. To determine whether the presence of people affected lions, the researchers estimated the size of sedentary human populations within a 50-kilometer buffer around each of the protected areas. Surprisingly, dense human populations around the areas didn't necessarily lead to the disappearance of lions. Instead, the authors theorize that pastoralists, seasonally transient livestock farmers, may be driving the large African carnivores toward extinction through their increasing use of poison to kill livestock predators. According to the IUCN Red List, the West African lion, Sierra cheetah, and West African wild dog are all listed as critically endangered.
A famous 104-year-old orca has made another big splash recently, and a lucky photographer caught her on camera. Just off the coast of Vancouver, Canada, Granny breached brilliantly as she led her pod through a narrow pass between islands, and Gary Sutton snapped the glamour shots, which Wild Whales Vancouver posted to its Facebook page. Arguably one of the world's most known animals, Granny, or J2, made waves last year when the discovery of her age, then a ripe 103 years old, spoke to how long orcas can live in the wild, as opposed to captivity. Granny's birthday is thought to be in 1911. That's before World War I and before the Titanic sank. The discovery of her birthday added to the already concerned public's evidence against keeping intelligent marine mammals like orcas in captivity and brought potentially bad news for SeaWorld, which profits off such practices. The latest images of the ancient orca are a reminder of how truly majestic these animals are, especially when they're allowed to live their long lives in the wild.
Eating a diet packed with fruits and vegetables may help women with an especially deadly form of breast cancer fight back against the disease, new research suggests. The study, led by investigators from the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, found that vegan diets may starve tumor cells, which are fueled by an amino acid called methionine. This amino acid is abundant in meat and fish, but low in fruits and vegetables. Consequently, a largely vegan diet may help stop the growth of tumors in patients with what is known as triple-negative breast cancer cells, the University of Wisconsin Cancer Center scientist reported in the journal Clinical Cancer Research. It's expected that clinical trials will find that a low methionine diet will help boost survival of breast cancer patients. Many studies have linked animal products with increased incidence of cancer, but many vegetables fight cancer. Among the most protective vegetables are the cruciferous vegetables such as broccoli, cauliflower, and kale, and mushrooms such as maitake and shiitake. Researchers in New York and in Tokyo have found that these mushrooms can reduce tumors by over 80%. It's becoming obvious that a well-planned vegan diet is the best protection from cancer. Stay with us. Coming up next, a conversation with Will Tuttle, a former Zen monk with a Ph.D. in education from UC Berkeley and author of the best-selling book, The World Peace Diet, which has now been translated into over 15 languages. That's next on ACT Radio. Joining us now on Animal Concerns of Texas, Will Tuttle. Hey, thanks for being with us, Will.
Thank you, Greg. I'm glad to be with you today.
Well, can you start out by telling our listeners how you started the path towards animal activism and veganism?
Sure. Just briefly, you know, I was raised in a typical family in New England, eating the usual meals, lots of meat, dairy products, and eggs, and I never really questioned it. I remember when I was about 7 years old, I said to my mother, so, you know, the kind of food we're eating, is this what everybody eats? And my mother just said, yeah, this is what everybody eats. Then she came back a few minutes later and she said, well, there are vegetarians. She said it in this way that I knew these people must live on another planet. She said, you know, she said she'd never met one in her life. And so I basically grew up, and that was the end of it. I just never thought about it again. I went away to a summer camp, I remember in Vermont when I was about 13, where we killed our own chickens and we killed our own cow, the dairy cow, when she stopped giving us milk. You know, we participated in all those things. For a few years I did that. Wow. And so I didn't like it, but on the other hand, I knew it was the right thing to do. You know, I knew God gave us these animals and they don't have a soul and they taste good and you have to eat them or you'll die within 24 hours of a protein deficiency, you know. And all the official stories were just totally injected into me. But luckily, when I got to college, it was back in the early 70s, I started hearing about vegetarianism a little bit, but I still never really identified with it at all. But then I left home and went on this, basically like a spiritual pilgrimage, it felt like at the time when I was about 22. I just turned 22 and I just graduated from college. My brother and I decided to try to make our way to California. And we ended up at the farm in Tennessee, which at that point in 1975 was the largest hippie commune in the world, basically, about 900 people there. And they were all vegetarians, you know, 900 people in this community out on the land in Tennessee. And they were actually what we would call today vegans because they didn't eat dairy or eggs either. And they were doing it for ethical reasons to not harm animals and to reduce world hunger. And they told me a little bit about what goes on, you know, to animals. And so at that point, when I heard this fellow telling me about this, and I had this example of a community who were, you know, thriving on a plant-based diet. They probably had 200 kids that were vegan from birth. That was it. I never ate meat again in my life since that day. And then a few years later, I got out to San Francisco eventually, and I heard about the cruelty to dairy cows into hens for dairy products and eggs. And so in 1980, I became a vegan. So that's now been 35 years ago. And immediately, I was an activist because I just really hated what I knew. I mean, I hated learning about this terrible cruelty to animals. And so I started going to protests. They were doing face branding of calves. I remember back in the late 80s or somewhere around there, and started meeting animal rights activists. And I went actually in 1984, I became a Zen monk and shaved my head in Korea. And I found myself for the second time in my life in a community that was vegan, although this time this was a community that had been vegan and practicing veganism for about 750 years. You know, it was an ancient tradition going back to the 1200s of people who lived in this monastery and meditating, you know, all day and essentially trying to awaken to a higher level of consciousness. And for them, for this tradition, you know, this was really seeing that to be kind to animals and to give animals justice and their ability to live their lives was essential for any kind of possibility of human happiness and freedom for ourselves. And so when I came back to this country in 1984, I remember I felt like I had these roots of veganism that went much deeper. I could see that it's not just a newfangled hippie idea from California. This is an ancient wisdom tradition that goes back thousands of years, and that people have been trying to awaken humanity to the devastating effects of animal abuse and animal agriculture, really for thousands of years. But it's like this hypnotic trance we're injected into from the time we're born, and very few people are able to awaken out of the violence that they're committing because we're so disconnected from it and because it's so injected into us by our culture's meals. And so I got my PhD at Berkeley and started teaching college courses and, you know, in a sense requiring my students to read Peter Singer's books and other books, you know, to try to force them to come to terms with some of the things that I had come to terms with. But basically, that's, you know, that's kind of how it is, you know. And then my research at Berkeley and following that led to writing the World Peace Diet, which tries to show the bigger picture of our culture's routine mistreatment of animals for food and other products.
You know, it seems to me that most of the spiritual traditions of the world have some sort of mention of vegetarian or veganism. At least the basic concepts and ideas that we should respect our fellow creatures and not cause them harm, especially so with Buddhism. And yet so many Buddhists, like Christians as well, seem to disregard the teachings that emphasize this idea.
Right. That's something I've struggled with, you know, for 35 years, the Buddhist tradition, as well as the Christian tradition, the Unitarians, you know, progressives in general, environmentalists and social justice people, women's liberation people and racial equality people and social justice of various kinds. You know, they still are eating animals typically because our culture just sort of injects it into people. And I think religion, you know, like you say, Greg, religion has been, like science in a sense, too, sort of a two-edged sword in the sense that there's great teachings to not harm animals, to show justice, to show compassion to animals in virtually all the world's religious traditions. I've studied this really a lot, actually. And yet, on the other hand, these traditions also validate animal, or they don't question it really. They allow people to continue eating animal foods. So you can go to the church barbecue or to the Buddhist temple where they're serving fish or whatever, and or at least dairy nowadays. And it's, you know, to me it's a real major disconnect. And the same thing is true, of course, with science. You know, science, you would think, would show very clearly, and in some ways it has, that we don't need to eat animal foods to be healthy. It's completely unnecessary. We understand that from nutritional research. But on the other hand, science is used to imprison animals more brutally than ever and to hyper-confine them and manipulate them and do horrible violence. So technology, like religion, I think they're very similar in a lot of ways. Both of them are, I have a chapter about this in the World Peace Diet, are really could be liberating, you know, they could be liberating, but in many ways they are, I call them the sons of the herding culture. They're products of the larger cultural mindset, which is herding animals, which is basically owning animals as property to use for food primarily and for other products. That's still the basic orientation of our society, and most people don't realize that. Most people think we live in some kind of a modern industrialized world, which is true, but it's based on herding animals. Hmm. And we have to understand that, that we live in a herding culture. We're not standing around in fields with crooks, you know, prodding sheep around. But we're still, essentially, that's the kind of culture we have where billions, literally, of animals are killed every year. They're hyper-confined in these stinking sheds where they never see the light of day, and not a lot of workers are needed anymore because of the technology. But it's organized around herding animals completely. And so for us to understand our culture, we have to see that herding cultures typically are patriarchal, warlike, and environmentally devastating, always have been. And we have just taken that to the next level. Since we're still herding animals and still owning them, we have still those same basic traits, because we're forced when we eat animal foods to disconnect from this kindness and caring for animals, and really for the respect for the sacred feminine dimension, since we're always impregnating these female animals. It's a really whole world of violence. And religions, I think, have tried in some ways to, you know, certain voices within religions to help, but pretty much, you know, the bigger picture is the culture we're born into is so powerful.
And, well, you know, a lot of people, if you feel empathy for animals or you cry when you see an animal hurt or something like this, in our culture, people are cried for showing this kind of outward compassion to animals. And I think most people agree that young children are very upset and feel very badly when they see an animal in pain. How can we get people to reconnect back with this innate compassion that we have for life instead of, you know, buying into the industrial mindset of herding, of the herding culture like you just spoke about? I mean, that's what we're in the vegetarian, mm-hmm. vegan, animal rights movements. That's what really, you know, could be the most powerful way, is to get people back into thinking that compassion is a good trait, not something to be embarrassed about.
Well, you're absolutely right, you know, and in the research I did, actually, for the World Peace Diet, I could see very clearly that especially boys, you know, especially males, we've been raised for the last 10,000 years to be hard, tough, and disconnected, because the male herder has to be that way. You know, in order to stab animals, to confine animals, to fight off rival herders and so forth, to control animals, you have to just harden your heart and be tough and hurt them. And because they're powerful, animals are, you know, they're resisting constantly. Animals are constantly resisting. They do not want to be confined. They do not want to have their babies stolen. They do not want to be impregnated against their will. And so boys have been taught to be hard and tough and disconnect from their natural feelings of kindness and caring. And girls have taught them, unfortunately, similarly, to be looked at by males as objects to be used, which is really what herding culture teaches. And so these traits are deeply injected with every single meal. That's the thing. Every meal is a ritual where we inject these values, these behaviors, and these ways of seeing and thinking and feeling into young kids. And it goes right through our whole, and it's still happening even when we're adults. And every time we sit down and eat meat, dairy products, or eggs, that's the method that's being injected into us by our cultural meal rituals, which are the most powerful rituals, the most powerful way we learn anything. So to answer your question, you know, how do we counteract that? It's really about education, I think, more than anything. And somehow, I'm not sure, some people use more shock tactics, trying to, you know, go into a store and shouting, it's not food, it's violence, and help people wake up. You know, other people, I tend to be a little more, trying to just articulate the ideas in a way that people can hear them, and begin to question the official narrative of our society that makes humans dominant, and this sort of male supremacy that we see everywhere. I think education is the key to talk about, think about, however we can do that in a way that's effective.
And I think another method of outreach that's gained a lot of momentum in recent years is video and films.
Right, yeah. I think video and films is really, in the arts in general, when you bring music in and imagery, you know, that these hit people at such a deep level, more than concepts. I mean, concepts are wonderful. Like, just talking and seeing the concepts can be very helpful. But when you bring that through film, and we can show sort of juxtaposition imagery of animals celebrating their lives, and then other imagery of animals being confined and harmed by humans, you know, anyone who sees that realizes this is not right. And the deeper message is, I don't want to be part of this. Another thing I think that's helpful besides the films and the movies, which are enormously important, are having vegan foods available conveniently. That's a big problem. People just feel like it's socially difficult, for them to change.
And that's been exploding in recent years as well. And speaking of films, the Vegetarian Society of El Paso recently had a showing of Cowspiracy. And I understand the director of that film was a graduate of the World Peace Diet Study Group in Cincinnati.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Kip Anderson. It was really good. I remember very clearly when, it was it must have been 6 or 7 years ago. I guess now we were giving the World Peace Diet facilitator training in Cincinnati, and Kip was there. He flew out from San Francisco with his girlfriend, and they were in the training, and along with some other people, of course. And we stayed in touch afterwards, and he told me he wanted to make a film. He wanted to make it about the World Peace Diet and the main ideas, and then he said he was going to focus mainly on the environmental impact, and he said he wanted to call it Cowspiracy. And what did I think of that title? He said he didn't think it was a very good title. Good title, So anyway, he did a great job.
He
just told his story, and it's really one of the first movies to actually help people see the connections beneath the surface between the environmental movement and the reason people are not really getting the message from the environmental movement. And it's such a helpful thing. And a lot of people, I think, are questioning their food choices and going vegetarian, going vegan by watching that film.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we had one of the guests at our viewing. That's what they wrote on their comment card. And they're going to be vegan now. So it was a very powerful movie. And, it did have some shocking footage in there, I guess you would say. And and so sometimes that's one of the other issues that we have when we're trying to reach people. How far should you go to wake people up? Because some people, shy away from that and say, I'm not going to watch anymore. I don't need to see that. You need people to wake up, but you need to wake them up in a way that, will spur them into the right action.
Well, I think it was important to have the beheading of the duck scene. It was very difficult to watch. And the strange thing was, just that morning I'd written a blog for Main Street Vegan about ducks. And then to watch that scene that night, it's going to stay with me forever.
Right. Yeah, that's true. I think it's always one of those choices. What do we really show? What do we want to expose people to? And I think we all wrestle with that, and to do it in a way that's not too much. I think the reason that was so powerful in that film, though, was because following that, he talks about having to go to another place and have to go through this again and see a chicken be killed. And then he says, well, I decided I didn't want to do that, so I didn't. And then he had this beautiful picture of him and the chicken on the front seat of the car. And everybody's hearts just opened, and I think it was brilliant how he did that.
Another important message was, you saw the little kids standing there watching the whole process. And like you said, that's part of that acculturation of, this is normal. It's just something you have to do, is what the dad said, as he's dismembering the duck in front of the small child, and the kid is obviously distressed by it.
Right, just like his father had done to him. You can see it going through the generations. And that's really what it boils down to. It's just something that passes through the generation.
I mean, I think the struggle for so many people is whether seeing this kind of thing in video or on a website is tough for them. And one of the things that stuck with me from your talk when you were in El Paso a couple months ago was making it into a positive about your diet. And you said to eat with love, joy, and appreciation. And I really found that hit the heart, because, you make your daily dietary choices into a positive change for the planet. And I think that resonates well with so many people as well.
Right. Yeah, I think that's an important aspect, to see that another word, another word for veganism is love. Another word for veganism is kindness, is caring, is freedom, is compassion, and so forth, that we're really living a life of joy, a life of abundance, a life where we're blessing others. What could be better? It's a life where we're caring and where we're healthy, we're contributing to the health of the planet, we're contributing to the health of hungry people who would be starving, we're not causing our fellow brothers and sisters to harden their hearts instead of animals, we're allowing water resources to be used more wisely, as well as land and other resources, and we're really shrinking our environmental footprint, and we're being a positive example for children and for each other, and it's something we can really have self-esteem and self-respect about, and we're working to show respect for those who are least respected. And so, it's just an incredibly positive message, and I think the most important thing really is to always reaffirm that in the minds of people we're talking to, that it might look like it's some form of renunciation, and in spiritual traditions, mm-hmm. it's always, renunciation is part of awakening. And people think, oh, I don't want to give something up. But the beauty is that when you give something up that's bad, I mean, like giving up, say, being addicted to alcohol or cigarettes or whatever, that people say, oh, I don't want to give something up. But we get so much more, and we get so much, the benefits are enormous by giving up meat, dairy products, and eggs. It's not giving up anything. I mean, it's gaining peace of mind and a world where peace and freedom and justice are actually possible. So it's just a tremendously positive thing to do.
And I think it feeds itself, too. It helps your compassion grow to live this kind of life.
Yeah, absolutely. Compassion and happiness, everything.
Tell us where our listeners can go to learn more about the World Peace Diet.
Oh, sure. Yeah, we have a website, worldpeacediet.com. And from there, if you want, you can go to worldpeacemastery.com. There's a link if anyone's interested in. We have a World Peace Diet facilitator training, and we have people that go through that. If you want to go into these ideas more in depth and then lead, perhaps lead local study groups or perhaps make a movie like Kip did or various things, it's an online self-paced training. And there's also our tour schedule is on there. We give a lot of lectures and travel quite a bit. And in fact, we're planning to do a major lecture tour in 2016. Most of 2016, we're probably going to be on the road, traveling all over North America as well as probably other continents as well. So just you can go there and see where we're going to be, and we'd love to meet people and continue to bring the message as best we can and work together, really, to bring this message to the world.
We've been talking with Will Tuttle, author of the best-selling book, The World Peace Diet. Thank you for being with us on the show, Will.
Thank you all so much. It's been great, and thank you to all the listeners for being part of this as well.
Now the monsoon season is upon us with the wonderful rains. It also does bring along with it a habitat for mosquitoes. And, of course, we need to protect our pets against heartworm. And so make sure you go to your vet and get your companion animal tested for heartworm and get them on the right kind of medication.
If you'd like to learn more about a vegan diet, please visit the Vegetarian Society of El Paso at vsep.org.
And if you'd like to listen to some of the past shows of ACK Radio, you can find them at ktep.org. Just click on the listen button.
Until next time, I'm Greg Lawson.
I'm Tom Linney.
And I'm Liz Walsh. For the animals, the earth, and a healthier humanity, thanks for listening to Animal Concerns of Texas.
We gotta have peace to keep the world alive and war to cease. Up here.